Live from the Ken and Valerie Baker Studio at WHYY, this is Studio 2.
On Wednesday, May 20th, welcome, 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 friends, on into the program. I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman-Aaron. Today, we are talking about the Pennsylvania primary results, who won the nominations, and what it all tells us about the voters, the issues, and what it means for Democrats' efforts to flip four critical seats in the Commonwealth. Once again, Pennsylvania will be a political battleground headed into the midterms.
Yes, and later this hour, we'll look at some of the biggest national races, including the Senate race in Texas, which has become more complicated with President Trump's endorsement of State Attorney General Ken Paxton over incumbent Republican John Cornyn.
First, let's start in the only city that really matters, Philadelphia. A closely watched primary yesterday ended in a victory for Democratic Socialist candidate State Representative Chris Rabb. The 3rd Congressional District, which covers much of Philadelphia, is among the most Democratic in the country, almost guaranteeing that Rabb will win the general election. He joins us right now on the heels of his victory. State Representative Chris Rabb, you are now poised to go to Congress. Welcome to Studio 2.
Thank you so much.
Yes, and congratulations to you on your win, sir. By the way, you won besting your next closest opponent by 15 points. And so my first question for you is pretty simple. Why do you think you won?
Well, I believe that my campaign, my candidacy, and my platform and how I campaigned resonated with the most people. And those are folks who did not see themselves in conventional campaigns currently and in the past, who felt a connection to something bigger than any one moment or any one candidate, in fact, that this is more about movement and making sure that the folks closest to the pain felt seen, respected, and included in a platform that was based on hope and substance and bold change that we so desperately need.
What issue or talking point do you believe really differentiated you from your opponents in this race?
Well, I think the fact that I was a grassroots candidate, you know, funded by the people. I think the numbers speak for themselves. I had over 7,000 people donate, the most Philly donors, the most small donors, the most young voters, the most ethnically diverse donors and volunteers, people who are willing to spend hours talking to their neighbors, knocking on doors. This has been an extraordinary affirmation of organizing and the fact that organized people beat organized money every time.
Yeah. I have to ask you, sir, because the Philadelphia Inquirer put out a map showing where you won the majority, and it's in Northwest Philly, Fairmount, Rittenhouse, South Philly. But majority of Democrats, specifically in those areas like North Philly, Strawberry Mansion, Parkside, Overbrook, West Oak Lane, where many blue collar areas of the city, they voted for Street or Sanford in the majority. So I just want you to talk about what you'll be doing over the next few months leading up to November and possibly even you going to Congress to connect with those voters so that they understand that they're also heard as part of your district.
Well, I must be looking at a different map. I won in Roxborough in the 21st World Ward, very much working class. I won in Cedarbrook, majority black district and community. I won the 50th ward, whose ward leader is Mayor Sherelle Parker, that's 99% black. So those demographics represent the diversity of this district. So I would push back on that. I think it's, in fact, working families who have been the strongest supporters of my candidacy, and that has been my base for 10 years. I represent currently the bluest legislative district in the Commonwealth, which is majority black and mixed income. And I believe that my win affirms the rainbow coalition of supporters.
The Democratic machine, the party in the city, did not back you. What's your message for them after your victory?
They need to change or, you know, they're going to have an existential threat. I think that threat is upon them now.
What's the threat? What's the threat that they face?
that entrenched power is not sustainable, right? Look, if you have the entire political class of Philadelphia, you have the entire establishment backing one opponent who, you know, has represented, you know, traditional politics in Philadelphia, and is beaten by 15 points, that's a sign. That's a sign. And here's the thing. It's not that, look, I have a good relationship with Senator Street. He called me last night, and I appreciate that. And we will remain colleagues, and we have so much in common. But the model for that kind of campaigning and that kind of politics, it's dead. Yeah. And look, if it weren't, I wouldn't be in office today. I beat the political establishment three times.
Can I ask you one more question before we get you out of here? Maybe Cherry's got one more, too. Yeah. I am curious what you think is the biggest risk you took in your campaign.
The biggest risk?
Yeah.
The biggest risk was running. Right.
What do you mean by that?
Well, I mean, it's like I'm a black Democratic socialist running in a machine dominated, you know, city. Right. And with strong views that have been warped and misinterpreted and by mainstream media and other, you know, folks in the political class. There's a tremendous risk with a black person with my politics, particularly in this moment in time where, you know, there's political violence. And that's something I don't take lightly. And I've had to address it in this campaign. This is serious. And it's why good people don't want to run for public office. But I feel a commitment to doing that because that is the legacy I've inherited from my ancestors for centuries doing this work fighting for racial justice.
And I'm going to squeeze one more question as we wrap up. I know you represent a very blue district. You mentioned that. Do you think some of your messaging could translate nationally as folks look through and they're trying to grab on strategies and to win in the midterms? What part of your messaging do you think would translate to a national Democratic message?
Fighting fascism. Doing things that actually address affordability and taxing the ultra wealthy and going after MAGA extremism and, the Epstein class. Those things resonate, and they resonate with people far beyond the blue base. These are things that impact all kinds of working families, irrespective of their political ideology.
All right. Well, we cannot technically call him congressman-elect yet. We'll still call him State Rep. Chris Rabb. Thank you so much for joining us today on the show, Chris Rabb.
My pleasure.
All right. And now we're shifting to our broader conversation about yesterday's results and what it means for Democrats heading into November's election. With us, we have two political strategists who come from very different sides of the party. We have Annie Wu Henry, a progressive political and digital strategist. Annie, welcome to Studio 2.
Thanks for having me.
We also have Mustafa Rashid, a political consultant and president and CEO of Bellevue Strategies. Mustafa, welcome back to Studio 2.
Thank you for having me.
And we'd love to hear from you this hour. What are your big takeaways from this primary season in Pennsylvania, across the country, however you want to take that? What do you think these results say about the political mood in the country right now? Give us a call, 888-477-9499, email studio2@whyy.org, YouTube, Facebook. Leave a comment in the live chat.
And Mustafa, Annie, you both heard what Chris Rabb had to say. Got to ask you first, Mustafa, why do you think Chris Rabb won?
He presented himself this time, as he has the other five times that he ran and won, as an anti-establishment and movement candidate. And in a time where people are uncertain about if politics works for their lives, fits in their lives, he presented that he's a case for the anti-status quo and that he should be elected. He would do things differently. And in the kind of turnout that was yesterday, momentum, he had all the momentum, it felt like it. He ran a smart campaign. He ran a sturdy campaign. And his message came across. It resonated with people. He drew the plurality of votes and he won.
Yeah. Annie, your thoughts? Same. You agree with Mustafa here?
Yeah. I think that, as you were saying, people don't know if politics works for them. And people are struggling in this environment right now. Mm-hmm. And people are looking for candidates and politicians, but as Rab often said in his campaign, public servants that will show up for them. And I think his campaign really highlighted that he will do that, not only, you know, from physical, I'll go out in the community, I will rally with people, but I will listen to you and I will hear you, and even if people don't agree with me. And I think that he, coming from, you know, the non-establishment world, and not taking any corporate PAC money, he is someone who's saying, I will listen to you. I am not listening to special interests. I'm not listening to corporations. And people, that is what people want right now.
You know what? Just if I could, just one other thing. You asked, Abby, you asked him a question about his biggest risk. And I thought he would say he quit his day job.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he did not rerun, which you can do in this.
He did not rerun his state house seat. I got to tell you, for a lot of people who get frustrated that politicians run for one office while they have another office, he said, I'm going all in on plan A. I don't have a plan B. I'm going all in on plan A. And I think when you go in on plan, all in on plan A, you burn the ship's mentality, like this has to work.
I
think that was a, not only just a risk, but it was the right thing to do. I'm telling you that I believe in myself. I want you to believe in me too. And I think that argument is easier to make when you demonstrate that you believe in yourself.
Bet on yourself. Let's bring in a caller. This is Chris from Center City. Not Chris Rabb, different Chris, I assume, calling from Center City. Chris, you're on Studio 2. What's your reaction to yesterday's results?
Hi. So thanks for taking my call. What I think these results really show is that Democrats are tired of these centrist, third way, focus group tested messages, and that really with someone who's unapologetic about being progressive, that kind of agenda really resonates with voters a lot more.
Yeah.
Your reaction to that, Annie, because look, Chris Rabb called himself a democratic socialist. Look, he's not the first, but that was a label that some people would have run away from. And some people do run away from. What do you think, I guess, about his sort of self-identification it helped or did not help him in this particular race?
Yeah, I think that it labels at this point, I don't think that they are as important as people make them out to be.
Yeah.
But I do think him self-identifying as a democratic socialist, he's owning it. Right. And I think so much of politics and politicians right now, they give a lot of word salad and you don't know what that means. What do you actually stand for? And we're not going to agree with every politician ever. We shouldn't, honestly.
Right.
And I think that we look at Pennsylvania's third district and not everyone who voted for him is a democratic socialist. Mm-hmm. But he was able to communicate that the issues that he is going to champion, the things that he is going to work towards and fight for, they will help you in your everyday life. And I think the same thing about when we look at, you know, Mayor Mamdani's race in New York City. New York City, they're not all democratic socialists as well. And so I think that these labels that people feel like we get kind of honed into, as long as you're able to communicate that your policies are things that will help people in their lives day to day be better, I think that they will vote for you, and you being honest about what that means for you and what you stand for is what people are really looking for in a politics that there's not a lot of trust.
Can we flip it for a second? Mm-hmm. Because a lot of the major unions, a lot of the people in the local party lined up behind Sharif Street in this race. Mustafa, why didn't that translate to more votes?
It should have. Traditionally, labor endorsements means that you're going to have a robust get-out-the-vote operation on election day. Like that's almost more important than money or the actual endorsement itself. But early returns that I've seen for Philadelphia show that the voting turnout was about 20%. And you can't have a robust get-out-the-vote operation if you're only one out of five voters actually show up. And so in a low turnout race, the momentum candidate, the candidate that has the best message, the candidate that has the best momentum is going to be the one that makes a difference.
But why can't the unions and why can't the machine turn out voters? I mean, this is not, doesn't seem to be the first time
it's
happened.
It's not. It's been trending down for quite some time. Annie and I talked about this out in the hallway. It's been trending down in Philadelphia County for quite some time. Since 2016, Philadelphia's share of the statewide electorate has gone from 21% to 18% to 16% to 2024. It was in single digits. So it's been trending down for quite some time. Part of the dynamic of being a big, poor city in America is many people woke up yesterday and found out for the first time it wasn't election day.
Yeah.
They didn't know. Their heads are down. They're working. They're doing what's in front of them. So many people didn't know. And a lot of people decided, I'm going to go do something that makes an actual difference in my life. I'm going to go to work.
Yeah, but that's the party's job, though.
Well, and I would say that I would go to the Philadelphia Democratic Party, and I would say, what have you been doing over the past few years to make sure that Democrats, which is the majority of this city, are understanding what is at stake for them, their constituents, and how they can get involved. I think a lot of people don't see themselves in politics, and I don't know how much our party infrastructure, particularly in this city, has been doing to make sure people who don't feel included in that field, don't feel seen in that, feel that they can be heard and be active participants.
Correct. You can't wait till election day to go tell people it's
an
election.
And I'm looking at a lot of comments. I posted something about this race early this morning. A lot of people said that they did not care who the political establishment wanted to vote for. They didn't care what the mayor thought about who should win this race or other politicians should win this race. I mean, instead, they wanted something different. And so I did want to shift gears a little bit and ask about outside money, you know, and outside attention. We saw people, Cory Booker was stumping for a street yesterday, but you also saw National Progressives stumping for, you know, Chris Rapp. How do you think outside national voices influence this race?
They do. It's funny. I had a conversation with a friend of mine this morning who said, I don't know much about Chris. And I said, you know the people that don't like him. Mm-hmm. That gives you some insight into the people that do like him. And so if national progressive politicians are saying he's with us, he's unapologetic, progressive, he's into the things that we're into, that gives you some roadmap of what he's into. I think that the mood across the country is anti-incumbent and anti-establishment. Mm-hmm. And if you're trying to run in any of those two lanes, you're going to have a really hard time. Chris was able to do, even as a 10-year incumbent, was still able to run as an anti-establishment progressive candidate. And that, to me, differentiated himself from the rest of the
Go ahead, Anna.
I was just going to say that I think that, well, Pennsylvania is, I'm biased, but Pennsylvania is the center of the universe in electoral politics. And I think that this race particularly, because it is so blue and the primary winner is almost guaranteed the seat and could sit there for quite some time. I hope not till they're like, you know, 100 years old. But I, which they often do. But I think that people know what this means outside of just, you know, Chris Rapp getting elected. Yeah. Mm-hmm. This tells a lot more about, it is one of the most important cities, the most important voting blocks when it comes to the city of Pennsylvania, which we know electorally in a presidential race is a key state. And this person who gets elevated to Congress, who they endorse, who they're going to stump behind, the signals that they send, the energy that they were able to present from like our base of the bluest blue voters. Mm-hmm. I think that that sends a larger message about where Democratic politics is looking to go, and politicians getting involved wanted to, you know, be a part of that conversation.
And if we zoom out a little bit, because I know this is the most, to us, this is the voice, the third district has been the one we're paying most attention to, but there are four seats that Democrats are targeting to flip in November, and it could very well determine the power in the house. And so we have the 7th, the 1st, the 8th, and the 10th. I'm just throwing out there to you guys, like Annie, Mustafa, which ones are you paying most attention to? Which ones do you think Democrats have a real chance of flipping in November?
Yeah, so in Bucks County, Brian Fitzpatrick has been there, I think, 5 terms now.
First congressional,
First congressional district. Mm-hmm. I think this one is going to be one of the most watched in the country. Democrats have run candidate against Representative Fitzpatrick for quite some time. This time, last night in the primary, Bucks County Commissioner Bob Harvey won the primary. He was endorsed by Governor Shapiro, who endorsed several candidates in this primary season in congressional races. This one's going to get a lot of attention. It's right outside of Philadelphia. It's all Bucks County and a small portion of Montgomery County. It's going to get a lot of attention. Representative Fitzpatrick has distanced himself from Trump, has tried to remain independent and vote his conscience for most of the time. But
and
that's hard to do.
He's been given the leeway.
Trump, correct. But that's, you know, I don't know if that's going to do it this time. But he's a prodigious candidate. He's a prodigious fundraiser. And he knows what he's doing, and Commissioner Harvey has his work cut out for him.
Yeah, and by the way, Trump in the past has given him leeway, did just come out and make some comments very recently, kind of slamming him. Not exactly sure if that's a strategic move or just Trump kind of flying off the cuff there, but you know, that could be a problem for him if it continues. Bit curious, again, same question to you, Annie. What you're watching, the race that most intrigues you of the flippable
totally.
Seats.
I mean, I grew up in central Pennsylvania. I've been following, obviously, that race pretty closely over also the last few cycles of them trying to build power there, which I think is also going to be quite a difficult path. But I think, you know, I went to college in the Lehigh Valley. It's such a diverse and interesting place. I think that the Bob Brooks coalition that he has built is really fascinating and also something that we...
Seventh district, that
we can learn about. He was endorsed by everyone from, you know, Josh Shapiro and figures like Pete Buttigieg, the Blue Dogs, to also, you know, Bernie Sanders and WFP and progressives getting behind him. And groups like, you know, someone brought up in the caller in, like Third Way, like the majority Dems elect the bench, that world endorsed Bob Brooks. I think that, but I also want to look at policy, right? And he is a working class candidate. I think people want to see themselves in politics. But also, he did not compromise his values. Yeah. He was still Medicare for all. You know, he was still saying that and won in not, you know, a staunchly blue area. Yeah. And people showed up. And I think it is about communicating the message of how your policies will help people's lives and that they trust you, that you will do that.
And my quick follow up to both of you, I mean, both of those races, Governor Josh Shapiro put his thumb on the scale for the candidates that clearly came out successful in both of those races. Just wondering how influential Shapiro will be for the midterms and for candidates getting elected, given what we saw in the third district where people were so anti-establishment, anti-party.
Yeah, I think as we get closer to the fall, and the governor has weighed in on these races, as candidates and parties look at control of Congress, I think people are a little bit more pragmatic in their approach and what it is they want to see. I think one of the fascinating things that Annie mentioned about the people that support Bob Brooks is it feels like possibly Democrats are no longer doing purity tests for their candidates, right? That if you come from all different walks of life, that you don't have to be this kind of Democrat. We just want you to be a Democrat and that you could prevail and be the best possible candidate for your district. And so I think that there's some telling points that can come out of that. There's some telling points that come out of the other races across Pennsylvania to see if the candidates are the right ones for that. And can they get the job done? I think that's where we're at right now. Can they get the job done?
Do they have ideas?
Yeah. And I mean, we didn't talk about Paige up in Scranton. And I think that's going to be an interesting race. She was obviously unopposed in this primary. So people weren't watching it as closely. Mm-hmm. But it will be a very contentious general. And she's a well-liked mayor. I think Bresnahan... People don't trust him. He ran on that he wasn't going to trade stocks in Congress and has traded more stocks than many members of Congress since he's been there. And that is, I think, when it comes to the trust piece, that people have so little trust in the government and that they care and that they're listening and that they're going to follow through with what they say they are. And that is the people, whether it is Bob Brooks or Paige or Rab, that come through as what I am saying, I mean.
Authenticity.
And I think that the Democratic Party has had a real struggle with that over the past few cycles.
Most of our comments are about PA3, so I do want to circle back there. Email from Josh, I worry that what gets someone elected in a primary is quite different than what gets someone elected in a general. Most voters are not hard left or hard right. Frank asks if Street and Stanford split the moderate establishment vote, giving a rabid advantage. And I want to ask a lot of chatter today, Annie, about whether progressives are more organized and have learned some hard lessons that came to fruition in this particular race, because Rab really had that progressive lane to himself. In the mayor's race in 2023, there was a lot of speculation that Reinhart and Gym pretty much split that vote, which gave Parker the path to win. Do you think progressives are more organized and tactical now than they've been in the past here in Philadelphia?
Yeah, I think that power has been growing, and we see that even when with our elected officials, right? With the growth of the WFP candidates that are in office, with
Working
the growth
Families
of,
Party,
of the progressives that are sitting in, you know, our state senate and our state house from Philadelphia in council. And so I think that, you know, it hasn't been overnight everyone is progressive, but I think that power is being built. I think that relationships have to be built, especially in so many of these older communities, in so many of the communities of translating what policy is going to do for people's lives. And when the machine politics, when so much of the city's politics has been, you know, dynasty folks or people kind of being handed a seat because the person before them said that it should be this person, there is that trust that people have with their ward leaders or whatever it might be that progressives do have to make inroads with, yeah, while as the machine still exists.
What about this idea, though, Mustafa, of like the people who are sort of on one wing of the party or the other being organized and basically saying, this is our candidate. We are going to coalesce behind a candidate. We are not going to risk a split. Do you think that is important in races like these? Is it more important than ever? Did the sort of more centrist wing of the party mess up here by not kind of clearing the lane? Your thoughts on all that?
No, so I think the races themselves matter. They all tell a dynamic and tell a story. In 2023, that was a race for the executive branch of the city. And I think that for progressives have not been able to clear that hurdle yet. New York, they have. In Philadelphia, they have not been able to clear that hurdle.
Jim Kenney,
No, for how you run a city as a progressive.
But Krasner for DA is what Andy's point.
Different. It's very, yes, very different. We're talking the chief executive of the city. And it depends on the mood of the city and the vibe of the city and trajectory of the city as well. If a city's doing really, really well, I think there may be a chance to take a risk on someone who has less executive experience. Up to this point, that has not been the case. And so I think we're willing to take a chance on a district attorney. We're willing to take a chance on Congress, state House seats and state Senate seats. But the executive branch, I still think, is a different category entirely for progressivism. And that hurdle hasn't been cleared yet.
But I will say organizing. I think that all of these races that we talk about, whether it's 2023 or the races since then, you know, we don't win a lot of them, but those, you do learn from them. You learn from them, you build from them, and also you do build power and you build that muscle of getting out and organizing and bringing people together and the groups coming together for different things. And I think that this cycle was a culmination of a lot of those, you know, those efforts in the past coming together and being built that we wouldn't get to where we are with this win in PA3 without.
Yeah. All right. Well, we will leave it there. Wonderful conversation. Thank you so much to Annie Wu Henry, progressive political and digital strategist, and Mustafa Rashid, political consultant and president and CEO of Bellevue Strategies. Thank you so much for being here. We appreciate you. And on the other side of this break, we're going to be talking national politics. If you have questions or concerns, email studio2@whyy.org. We'll be right back.
WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives. One moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
And welcome back, everybody, to Studio 2 on WHYY. I'm Avi Wolfman-Aaron.
And I'm Cherry Gregg. We're turning now to national election results. This has been a busy primary season with lots of twists and turns. There's turbulence in Texas, messiness in Maine, and a kerfuffle in Kentucky.
So what has the last few months taught us about the strength of Donald Trump, the direction of the Democratic Party, and the mood of the country? Here to help us explore those topics and more, we have Connor Lamb, former Democratic congressman from Western Pennsylvania. Connor, welcome back to the show.
Thanks. Glad to be here.
Yes. And let's also welcome Rena Shaw, political strategist and senior advisor to our Republican legacy. Rena, it's so nice to have you.
Hi. Nice to be with you all.
And we'd love to hear from you listening this hour. What are your big takeaways from this primary season? What do you think the results say about the political mood in this country? Give us a call, 888-477-9499, email studio2@whyy.org, YouTube, Facebook, comment in the live chat.
So we wanted to start broader with the primary season and last night in Kentucky. I just got to ask you first, Connor, then Rena, what did Donald Trump prove last night?
Well, he continued to prove the iron grip that he has over their party. But I think he proved something else, which is maybe more significant, and people aren't quite picking up on it. It's what made this race different. Massey, unlike the other people Trump has beaten, Massey was sort of claiming to be the true spokesman for the MAGA movement, particularly on the two issues of the war in Iran and the Epstein files, which I think have to be on the top five list of issues that Trump campaigned on in 2024 and for a long time. And Massey delivered on them and Trump did not. So this is the first time I can think of where the voters actually got what they wanted but Trump changed, and then he got them to change. Like they almost punished someone for delivering for them on a key issue, and that to me is just head spinning.
They stuck with Trump even though he switched them. He switched up on one issue. Rena, your thoughts? What did Trump prove last night?
Yeah, I think he proved the chokehold he has on his most ardent supporters. It's those people who show up in a primary. It's not a great reflection, the primary turnout of the party writ large. I think these are folks that are going to, of course, listen to the standard bearer. They are believing the president whenever he speaks. So they believe him when he says that Thomas Massie is a traitor who is stopping his agenda from getting done in Washington. So many mistruths were spoken about Congressman Massie. I think if you look at the guy on his face, you see somebody that actually is willing to represent conservatism in general. But again, in Trump's Republican Party, there's the loyalty test, and the loyalty test is now the litmus test for how candidates make it through elections. In general, I think what I'm looking at about from last night is a greater sense that there's going to be an uphill battle for more Republican candidates than perhaps would be expected.
Yeah. I want to read in some comments here. Brian says, everyone is making a big deal about Trump-backed candidates winning primaries. I believe this is a big win for Democrats. When it comes to general elections, independent and Democratic voters who are fed up with Trump and his Yes, Your Majesty GOP will make their voices heard loud and clear. Gregory agrees, says the more aligned with Trump that a candidate is will make it easier for their opponents to garner votes. This bodes well for the midterms. But does it, Connor? But does it? Because, look, this Kentucky seat is a safe seat. Mm-hmm. Are there instances out there, there are primaries out there where Trump is steering the Republican Party in a direction that could actually make it vulnerable in November?
Oh, absolutely. And I know you guys covered Pennsylvania in the previous half hour, but just think about what you're thinking if you're Brian Fitzpatrick today in the suburbs of Philly. So he might think to himself, I'm nothing like Thomas Massie. I've been a centrist. I've worked with Democrats. I've voted against my party sometimes. That's his view of himself. Mm-hmm. But the view of the Republican Party that we are getting from things like Massie's race last night and from Trump's endless, you know, antics is that you can't really hope for anything from a Brian Fitzpatrick because Trump is the one that controls the party and pulls the strings. And so, you know, if you're that sort of on the edge voter this fall and you voted for Brian in the past, it makes sense to vote against him because there's really no room for him to do anything separate from what Trump wants. That is so clear.
Even though he has done it sometimes in the past, you're saying they would be fearful that he couldn't do it in the future.
Or that when he does things, they're ineffective. So yes, like he sort of registered this protest vote against the One Big Beautiful Bill. I give him credit for that personally. Yeah. I like Brian and worked with him. But that didn't stop the bill, obviously, and it has not stopped Trump like one iota. And so, again, if you're upset about the war and what we're all paying at the gas tank and in all these other prices, you're looking at a guy like that and going, it just hasn't gotten me anything. And it turns out if you're not loyal to Trump, you can't really be an effective Republican. Yeah. So I got to go the other way.
And Lou Farrell says on Facebook, Trump's candidates were always going to win. It was a primary and only the regular voters turn out. The higher D turnout is the real story that gives me hope for the midterms. Is there room, Rena, for a Republican Party where elected officials can openly disagree with the president at this point? Or has that door sort of shut because of what happened yesterday?
Yeah, and I actually do believe that door has been shut. I hate to say it because there's been a large crop of Republicans who over the past decade have been saying that we can carry the mantle forward when the party is done with Trump. But in this moment, which is what I believe we're talking about, right?
Yep.
It's incumbents ignoring the Trump coalition at their peril. I mean, unity is not optional right now. It's being told to incumbent members of Congress who are Republicans that is how they hold the House and how they advance the agenda. I think look at Senator Bill Cassidy of Louisiana, who voted to convict Trump in that 2021 impeachment trial. He finished third behind the Trump-backed Representative Julia Letlow and another strong Trump-aligned candidate, Fleming, who had strong name recognition, I should also add, because he's a former elected as well. Cassidy failing to advance to the runoff was a big tell. And it also, it's this, the tell is this. even years later, crossing Trump on core constitutional fights has consequences. Cassidy's loss really proves the base hasn't forgotten disloyalty, that Republicans are rewarding proven fighters like Congresswoman Julia Letlow, who stand with the president on draining the swamp and delivering for working families, supposedly. This is the party realigning fully behind the agenda that they say voters elected. So the broader signal here is that personal grudges or never Trump remnants have no future in the modern GOP, near future, I should say.
Yeah. So the question is, what do Democrats then do in response, if indeed that is the case? And here's a Prolix on YouTube talking about the Massey defeat. I think Massey represented an anti-war conservatism. The voters rejected that view. Dems have a chance to appeal to these voters, but will they? And speaking about the PA3 race, and this kind of connects, Claudia says, Chris Rabb is the only one who takes the Israel situation seriously, calls it a genocide. He favors cutting off all military aid to Israel, something we must absolutely do in the cause of stopping the killing and destruction and upholding international law. Is this some sort of opening for Democrats to reach disenchanted Republican voters, maybe even pretty conservative ones? And if it is an opening, are there also risks if they take that opening, Connor?
Well, there's definitely an opening. And I lived through that once in 2018 where, you know, the district that I ran in originally, Trump had won by 20 points, basically 18 months earlier. Mm-hmm. And the reason some of those people gave me a vote, I heard it from them over and over again. It wasn't because they had even fully soured on Trump. They wanted him to be checked. They wanted a sort of a balance on his overreaches of power. And that is, you know, magnitudes worse today. So those same people are going to give that opportunity to Bob Harvey or Bob Brooks or whoever the case. You know, are there dangers? I don't think there's dangers necessarily for Democrats in reaching out to those people. I think that's good. I think it's just as we move forward, if you want to keep those people in the coalition, you do have to be flexible and remember that they're important.
Yeah. Got to ask about, you know, when we talk about, I'm thinking about a test of Trump's power and coming up, and we're talking about Texas. Specifically, he's endorsed State Attorney General Ken Paxton. We talked about that. We kind of teased it in the first half over incumbent Republican John Cornyn. Paxton has faced all sorts of issues, legal issues, criminal issues. And it might piss off some loyal Republicans. And Rena, would love to get your thoughts about that test, what question that tees up in the midterms when you hear, you know, you see Trump putting his thumb on the scale for a very controversial candidate in Texas.
Yeah. Wow. More than controversial. I'm really taken by the moment that is personality over principles. And I know this is something we've been dealing with Trump for some time now, but conservatism used to be about ideas and coalitions. I mean, Reagan built big tents. Mm-hmm. This is shrinking the tent this moment, what we see Trump doing, this purge of those who are not loyal to him. And then he's also going a step further to say, well, this guy's been loyal to me, so he's going to get my endorsement. It almost just puts you in a moment where you say, is the president of the United States serious? Does he understand the damage he's doing for the long term? Does he understand that he's really making this about a personality cult and a one-man rule? I mean, to some, like me, it doesn't feel like a party anymore. It feels like a throne room, because if you disagree once, somehow you're disloyal to America. And I reference Reagan, who won landslides by welcoming big tents. Trump's version really shrinks it to whoever kisses the ring the hardest. And I think that's what we see him doing with choosing Paxton. He could have sat that one out. What I think he's done is not projecting strength. I think he's showing that he's got insecurities dressed up as toughness.
Yeah.
There's a lot I want to say about Paxton. I don't think it's TV friendly. I'm completely taken. I don't even think I'm raised up in West Virginia, and I'm not Republican because I'm from a rural state. I'm Republican because I thought it was the party of Lincoln. I thought it was the party of limited government. I thought it was the party that could respect how our founders designed our system, where the legislative branch is a strong check on the executive, not members proving personal loyalty to the president because of party membership. But what I'm seeing the president do, wade into these messy races where he's got to pick somebody that is, to put it bluntly, just a real risk for Republicans heading into the midterms. I mean, it is a mind-boggling moment. It's not politically smart, and it is a moment where you have to really wonder what kind of playbook does he care about running in Texas? Not one that's smart.
And by the way, Democrats are watching this race because Paxton has faced multiple scandals, impeachment proceedings in Texas, for folks who may not know that. And he could make the seat much more competitive in November against Democrat James Tallarico. And so is this sort of an I see this, and a lot of people see this as an opportunity for Democrats in Texas, a huge red state.
Oh, it's a huge opportunity. Yeah. I think what's going on here is really simple, which is that Trump is the most corrupt president in American history. He is stealing from us every day. And Ken Paxton will definitely let him get away with that if he gets to Washington. Cornyn's a little bit more of a question mark because he's kind of been a McConnell guy, slightly more institutionalist, although it's hard for me to even say that. But that is the case. And so Trump has made a decision that's about his self-interest and not the interest of Republicans broadly. And Democrats are going to get the opportunity to capitalize on that.
What do you make of James Tallarico? This is also something that happened in the primary season, defeated Jasmine Crockett about 52-46. This was early March. I don't know if he can fits in neatly into any narrative that we're trying to craft about this primary season right now. We've been talking a lot about anti-establishment, sort of outsider figures. And I suppose you could say he is one, Connor, but he doesn't necessarily dress the part. And I'm just curious what you make of his candidacy and his chances in Texas.
What I like about him is that he has mastered the attention economy in a way.
Yes.
And so he is like sort of behind what you're saying is we're all paying attention to him and we're not exactly sure why. And that's a measure of success today.
Sure.
I also think that I was talking about corruption a moment ago, and James has really focused on that, not only the sort of give and take of what is Trump stealing from us and who is he paying off, but also this kind of corruption of the spirit or corruption of the soul that mm-hmm. we're getting as a result of social media and AI. And I think that's just a really necessary conversation for us to have. So I'm extremely happy that he's putting that in out front. It's a horribly difficult state for Democrats. There's all these different media markets. It's enormous. But he's going to make as much of a fight of it as can be made, I think.
Hmm. Another Democratic primary fight that never mm-hmm. really happened. It sort of happened, but didn't happen at the polls. Let's go up to Maine. This is a Graham Plattner seems very likely now to win the Democratic nomination and face off against incumbent Susan Collins. Mm-hmm. It seemed initially like the Democratic establishment was lining up behind Janet Mills, who's a former governor of the state. And I'm just curious what you make of the fact that she ends up dropping out before she even gets to election day. Like, what does it say?
I'm not sure her dropping out says all that much. She always seemed like a really reluctant candidate that was being kind of pushed into this race by mm-hmm. other people. Plattner clearly caught fire early. People up there like him in the Democratic primary. We're going to get a real test, though, this fall as far as, you know, all of these drawbacks that he has and the kind of, you know, out there policy positions and tone that he has taken. Is that sellable to a general election audience? Obviously, he feels that it is. You can look at
you
parallels.
You sound a little skeptical.
Well, I am. I mean, I'm not from Maine. And Susan Collins, although she's an institution, has been there so long that now maybe we're in such an anti-incumbent season that she pays for it. But I sort of look at the parallel that people often make between Plattner and Fetterman.
Yep.
And, you know, I think Fetterman triumphed in the general election in part because he had this cartoonish opponent, Dr. Oz, you know, and that's not what Plattner has. I mean, Susan Collins is a serious person who's been around the block a number of times.
Now, we should clarify, you did run against John Fetterman. And I will say, Leave Be Alone on YouTube says,
yeah, I had to
Connor, PA fumbled him so bad in 2022, we're paying the consequences now. So some buyer's remorse there from one of our YouTubers.
Not affecting my neutral analysis, though,
Thank you for that.
I am just pointing it out. But you do see some parallels there. Plattner firmly rejects those parallels, by the way, and say, I am not John Fetterman.
Right.
I am not John Fetterman.
And I think to his credit, I think Plattner has already been more substantive in his campaign than Fetterman was. And I think that Plattner is kind of taking on this issue of deeply entrenched corruption of the system that people want to have us take on. And I do believe he would oppose the things that Trump is doing and has the courage to resist that. And so, you know, that might take him there, just that.
Corey says online, turnout in primaries is almost universally smaller than the general and tend to attract more hardcore partisan voters that can lead to candidates that can energize a small and dedicated base, but not necessarily resonate with the wider public. And I'm noticing some parallels between, you know, the progressive Democrats and the MAGA, you know, Republicans. They like these unapologetic candidates that are just bold, willing to take positions. And so it makes me wonder, like, how do you think voters are going to fare, Rena, in the midterms? Are they going to be okay with more moderate voters? I mean, because not moderate voters, but more moderate candidates. Will these very decisive, more combative, more unapologetic folks resonate with people who are just kind of in the middle that were not part of this primary process? Because we have 1.4 million people in Pennsylvania who could not vote yesterday.
Yeah, it depends on when, at what point after these people get seated, should they make it through their primaries, right? And win the general. It depends at what point we ask the voters, well, what do you think of their performance? You know, in general, what we're seeing is a pivot point right now. Mm-hmm. Progressives are getting energized. You've got young voters feeling somewhat disaffected. And then you've got moderates feeling alienated. So we've got a trifecta of things going on that really impact races, whether they're Maine, Pennsylvania, or Florida. Let me use Maine, for example. Mm-hmm. I think Maine Senate races really favor Collins' really long record of moderation. That's been really unique up there with Susan Collins. She brings home pork for the state, and she's got cross aisle appeal, actually. Now, when you look at Susan Collins, she isn't pretty flashy, but she is effective. She's respected, and she's very Maine first. When you've got Plattner essentially representing the nationalization of Democratic politics, which to me is angry, extreme, and divisive at times. And that's what I think is getting Republicans fired up. This race is winnable up in Maine by really contrasting that proven leadership against the protest candidate energy. Do protest candidate work everywhere? Absolutely not. But I think, again, when you've got these trifecta of things going on, it makes for a storm in which maybe they do get seated, but how effectively they will govern always really creates a tough moment for midterms. And that's one thing I'm looking at in terms of changing trends, because I am an elder millennial. So I am somebody that is yeah. really kind of close to the issue.
Yeah. And Connor, your thoughts about moderate candidates in this climate where you see both parties sort of embracing the unapologetic, more combative candidates?
That's right. I mean, I think that I don't think the traditional kind of moderate progressive distinction is exactly the way to look at it. I think what we have is mm-hmm. a populace that is enormously frustrated with the status quo, and that you're seeing that in both parties. And so, you know, what you're getting, actually, interestingly, in a lot of these Democratic primaries, you're getting three candidates, kind of like we had here in Philly last night. You're getting like a Chris Rabb type candidate. You're getting a more establishment candidate, maybe like Sharif. And then you're getting someone that fits the establishment mold, but hasn't been in politics or hasn't been in Washington and says, I'm kind of an outsider, too, because I haven't been there. And I think that'll just be interesting to watch that dynamic we're seeing in the Michigan Senate primary, for example, mm-hmm. Where you might see some moderates actually do pretty well by embracing that anti-status quo posture that a lot of people feel and kind of balancing out the portfolio for some of these voters.
Interesting, yeah.
A few more comments wanted to read in here. Patrick on YouTube says, in Ambler, my ballot did not have a single contested race, a sign of a very unhealthy lack of democracy within the Democratic Party, just when we need to have a real competition over how to beat MAGA. Stefan says, I think the PA primary system discourages voting. I voted, but there was literally only one choice for each seat. Why did I bother? This does get to sort of a broader question of, if you're the Democrats, you're trying to reclaim power at the federal level, do you want sort of more fighting now, unity later, or do you want sort of unity now to project strength into November? And like, what's the better path strategically? Not talking about a matter of sort of morals or principles here, but strategically, and this goes to 2028 as well, should it be sort of a big, open, messy fight? Do we need to really talk about the future of this party? Or do we need a little bit more, I don't know, organization, Connor?
I think we probably need an honest family discussion followed by organization. And yeah. I think I believed maybe 6 years ago at this point, kind of in the run-up to 2020, you know, that presidential primary was difficult on the party, and it was difficult on people that were holding office at the time because there were all these kind of splits on yep. issues. And you remember the candidates having to raise their hands on stage and
yes.
stuff. Mm-hmm. And then I think part of the reason that a lot of the Biden people wanted him to run for re-election in 24 was to avoid that kind of discussion.
Yep.
And then even after he dropped out, they wanted to avoid an open process and just pick Kamala. And a lot of people were left feeling like that didn't work and that we've sort of buried some issues that we need to have debated and resolved before we can kind of organize and go forward. So I don't necessarily think it has to be a fight per se, but it's going to have to be a healthy and open primary season.
Yeah. Better Integra on YouTube says, thinking everything is about Trump and ignoring the people, underscored, is why your head is spinning. Labeling one person equals less fallout than labeling the majority of the country. It's also why the Democratic Party is now irrelevant and both sides are doing our best to shape the Republican Party. And so I guess as we go through the next few months and we head to the midterms, sort of what will you be looking for in messaging from either side to sort of see who is going to gain the momentum? You know, and I know we don't really pay attention until like Labor Day-ish. Mm-hmm. Everybody starts really starting to GOTV work. But just sort of what sort of messaging are you going to be looking for to see who is resonating most with voters, Connor, and then Marina, Connor?
For me, mostly I'm looking at accountability messaging. So I take the critique that your viewer has, and it's a fair one. I just, having been in that position myself, in a midterm, the voters aren't going to give you much room to talk about an affirmative new agenda as opposed to accountability on the president who's there. They want to know, like I said, are you going to check and balance him and give me something a little bit different in the exchange? After that, I think, is when the affirmative agenda conversation happens after 2026.
So, Rena, what will you be looking for as we head into the midterms?
Well, the Republican Party has changed a great deal in the 2 decades that I've been working inside of it. Just because my co-panelist did today is Connor, I wanted to tip my hat to him because actually because of the flip the Republican Party has done, I'm looking for who can connect with working class voters. And I thought that was something you did, Connor, when you were a candidate. I remember watching you, and I know you won and held tough swing districts in Western Pennsylvania, places that went for Trump. And so you proved that you knew how to connect with those working class voters. I think Republicans really need that because folks really want candidates who care about bread and butter issues like energy, jobs, and public safety. I know that's not a small feat in a very polarized time. I thought you did that. And look, I think you also showed a willingness to break from the national Democratic orthodoxy at times and supported steel tariffs and protecting natural gas in Pennsylvania. I grew up in West Virginia, as I mentioned, so not far from Pennsylvania. But we also, I'm looking for candidates who, again, like Connor, could work across the aisle on infrastructure, veterans employment, employment in general. In this era where too many politicians put party over country, I think I'm looking for those traits that are worth acknowledging. So whether we agree on policy or not, I really respect Connor's service and his thoughtfulness in debate.
Well, thank you.
Who would have thought we would end on a politics show in a kumbaya moment? So thank you, Rena Shah, political strategist and senior advisor to Our Republican Legacy. Appreciate your time today on Studio 2.
Sure. Thanks.
And always nice to see you, Connor Lamb, former Democratic congressman from Western Pennsylvania. Connor, thanks for being here.
Thank you.
Yeah. And thank you to everybody who wrote in. Lots of great comments today about the primary day. And have to say thank you to our producers, Debbie Builder, Hazel May Bryan, and Paige Murray Bessler. Mike Schiffler is our visual producer. Al Banks and Tina Calique engineered today's show. Our executive producer is Kevin McCory. From Studio 2 here at WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Cherry Gregg.
I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt. We'll talk to you tomorrow.